So welcome back to the Overseas Athlete Podcast, and today we have a very different type of guest for you. I'm very excited to introduce Matt Krog, who is one of the directors of Hope Earl Lawyers on the Gold Coast here in Queensland. Matt, good afternoon or good morning still. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good, thanks. Chris, thanks for having me on.
No, I'm very much looking forward to this. As I just sort of mentioned briefly off air, so for those that you can do a bit of research on Matt, but he's a lawyer here on the Gold Coast with a sporting background and heavily passionate about helping sports people and athletes on the legal side of things. So I thought it'd be a fantastic episode. I had a couple of conversations last week with a few basketballers, so one American and one Australian. And they've played in between them sort of 15 different countries. And their biggest obstacle or challenge or sort of, I guess, stress as well was their contracts. Obviously, if you're not if you're an athlete, you're probably not well versed in the ins and outs of contracts and different sort of sports laws and what you're entitled to. So, Matt, that's the reason to get you on, is to get your insights around, you know, how important they are, what questions athletes should ask, things they should look out for, and really just to make sure we can help educate and protect them. So, if you want to give us a bit of a background as to, you know, who you are and what you do, and we'll just dive in from there.
Yeah, easy. No, sounds good. As you said, I've been working as a corporate commercial and employment lawyer probably for the last 10 years, but really have focused on the sports industry. So the sports law itself is really a collection of a number of areas of law. So for me, it's important to have a good grounding in commercial, corporate and employment to be able to advise athletes or agents, even coaches in relation to various aspects of the work that they do. Over the last 10 years, I've been advising national sporting organisations, player agents, athletes, and I said coaches as well, in relation to every aspect of the law, really. Selection disputes, disciplinary matters, even corporate structure, when you're setting up your own business, or on the other end, you know, disputes between athletes and agents. Agents and athletes and things like that. So sort of cover a wide range of things there with the sporting industry generally. So
fantastic.
As you touched on as well, I think the main role of a sports lawyer for athletes in particular is really just around sort of education. Sometimes you don't necessarily need to change things. You just need to make sure that athletes are actually aware of, you know, what they're signing up for, what their sort of options are, and making sure that the agreement sort of reflects their understanding of what they're signing up for. Because, I mean, obviously you have agents there that can assist most of the time in most sports. But obviously agents have a sort of a wide range of things that they need to consider, and you know, sometimes they need a lawyer as well to actually assist in understanding the terms of the contract, assisting with the negotiations as well, especially when you start getting into the, sort of the nitty gritty and the details of certain transactions. So that's where we sort of come in. We don't try and sort of take over the situation. It's more to sit on the side and make sure you know, athletes and agents feel like they've got another, you know, member on their team, making sure that, you know, everything's been steered in the right direction and ultimately protecting the athlete's interests.
Yeah. And it's so important. And as I said at the start there, it's probably an area that people really don't know much about. I suppose the main things you look at when you see it is how much am I getting paid and when, like how often.
Yeah, well, that's right.
That's the two things that stand out, obviously, for everyone, whether it's just a standard employment contract or a playing contract.
Yeah.
But what are the other – what would be, you know, from your own experience, some of the main, I guess, issues or areas where people might get caught out that they weren't aware of?
Yeah, well, it really depends on where the athlete is looking to sign. So domestically, things are pretty consistent. But when you start looking at overseas contracts, that's when things become a little more unclear. Obviously, moving into a different jurisdiction, they might operate under a different legal system than what we have over here. There could be a lot of things that are different over there than the athlete's probably not aware of. And the main thing there is really in relation to sort of personal information. How is your information used? What can it be used for? How long can it be used for? Those are the kind of things that you probably should look at as an athlete. It's got a lot of attention recently locally. A lot of people are talking about the sensitive information that's actually being collected by clubs in relation to athletes. So whether it's health data, or, you know, even the GPS tracking, things like that. Athletes are starting to ask more questions about what's happening to my information, because it is sensitive and there is certain protections that athletes have here in Australia. But that's not to say that the same protections apply overseas. Yeah. So we're always looking at that. We're looking at image rights as well. So image rights, you obviously heard a lot about the, you know, the NIL deals over in the US. You always hear it. NIL obviously stands for name, image and likeness. So in Australia, there's really no recognized right to a person's image. So most of the protections for athletes come through the entry into contracts. So athletes that are wary of how their image might be used would need to have a look at not only the contract, but then if there's any other sort of CBA that's been entered into with any other organizations over there, you know, you need to really have a look at that and see if there are any protections in relation to the use of your image. And to what extent are you protected? To what extent do you have any control over the use of that image? So it sort of does go deeper there. And obviously, again, as I said, you're moving into a different jurisdiction. So you really want to know, A, how do things differ from how they are here? And we can advise on the Australian side of things. But then also it's always worthwhile to have a lawyer over in the jurisdiction in which, you know, the athlete's signing, to actually provide some advice there, so that the athlete has a clear understanding of what's going on. And of course, at this current moment, I think there's a lot of more money being thrown at sports, both locally and internationally. And previously, I think it's, you know, the cost of engaging a lawyer sort of been deterring other athletes from, you know, getting that advice. But from our perspective, sometimes there's little work required, sometimes there's a lot of work required, but it's always good to just be informed and receive that advice, so that you're not taking that leap of faith blindly, because as you said, some athletes might jump over into another country and then realize, you know, it wasn't what they thought it was going to be, and had they received advice, had the benefit of that advice, and maybe they would have made a different decision.
And on the we'll touch on a bit of that jumping into new countries, but just on the image side of things, so as just say, you know, a young Australian athlete, whether they're playing in the NRL, AFL, the A-League here in Australia, is there ways that they can they ask for their images to be put into their contract and negotiate some sort of fee if the clubs want to use them for advertising?
Yeah, so typically what happens is, say for the larger sports like AFL, NRL, their employment, the employees or the athletes' rights are sort of collectively negotiated through entry into a collective bargaining agreement. So usually at that level, that's where the negotiations take place in relation to the use of the image, how that can be used, and what benefits the athletes actually receive from the use of their image. So that can be from a, you know, at a club level, as well as a sort of each athlete, how they're actually remunerated or compensated for the use of their image. So that's typically how they do it in the larger sports. But then in your sort of smaller sports where, you know, there's not as much money being thrown into it, there's no association effectively or union bargaining on your behalf, then it really is sort of an individual negotiation. That's sometimes the issue, is that you have a number of people or athletes individually negotiating to try and determine how their image would be used, and it can get quite messy. But absolutely, there's an opportunity for athletes to have those negotiations, have those discussions. The question ultimately is, how much negotiation power do you have? So obviously, through the NRL and the AFL, you're dealing collectively with all the athletes. So it's a lot easier to negotiate there with the governing body, whereas in the smaller sports where there is no union or, again, association, the governing body is in a really good position to be able to say, well, we'll just do what we need to do, and we're not going to necessarily make too many concessions for your benefit because we want control. So it really depends on the level at which you're operating, and the willingness of the governing body to come to the table.
Okay. And then on sort of on that part, does that then limit, can that potentially limit any outside sponsorship opportunities athletes can take up?
Yeah, potentially. And ultimately, it depends on what the arrangements are at the governing body level, also at the team level. So again, in your professional sporting space, I suppose you would call it, you know, the clubs have certain obligations to their sponsors, the governing bodies do as well. So they're going to want to protect their interests and make sure that they're not putting their sponsors offside. So there's obviously going to be certain restrictions around the use of your image in certain settings, especially obviously using your image in combination with, you know, a club logo or, you know, a governing body logo. So it is important to actually ensure you're aware of what the scope of those rights are, so that personally for each athlete, they can sort of commercialize their own image and you know, start deriving an income from other sources outside of the game.
Yeah, yeah. Because I guess in some instances, you know, athletes can obviously earn a lot of money just from playing, whereas in others, the players might not earn as much, say, for their salary as such, but can pick up a lot of money in sponsorship and endorsement. So something like as trivial and to bring it back to like a real-life scenario, if your club was, say, sponsored by Adidas, but you were approached by Nike to wear their boots or their apparel, how would you negotiate, or is that a tricky situation, or is that something that happens quite often that people need to sort of overcome?
Yeah, so that's something that each athlete would have to deal with on sort of an individual basis with the club and with the governing body as well. So whenever an athlete, and again, I'm talking from the perspective of sort of the larger sports, but typically when there's a sponsorship like that, or most sponsorships, there is an approval process that needs to be followed. So if that were the case, athlete would then have to go to the club, go to the governing body and say, this is what I propose to do. Do you have any, you know, issues with me doing that? And if there are inconsistencies or crossover, then, you know, the parties will have to have a discussion about what the scope of that sponsorship could be like to ensure that there's no infringement or any breach of any other obligations owed to the, you know, existing sponsors or any other third parties.
Through the club. And would they approach that through their agent initially, or is that somewhere where you would, well, you'd obviously speak to your agent, but is this where you would maybe bring in a, or contact someone like yourself to look over the agreements and what's involved?
Yeah, well, I think even at the early stage, as soon as something has been drawn up, I think that's important, an important time for agents to sort of recognize it's probably when the work goes outside of the scope of their engagement as well. So, I mean, there's sponsorships everywhere. You know, they've been thrown to athletes of varying you know, values. And so, you know, when you're talking about the smaller sponsorships, then, you know, typically you say, well, you might be okay to just push on because there's limited risk there. But when you start talking about the larger value transactions or the long-term transactions, that's when we really say we need to be involved pretty early. But then if an athlete or an agent does get sort of a pushback from the club or a governing body and they think that, you know, probably no reason for it, we can, of course, get involved there and then have a look at how we can make things work, because as commercial lawyers, we don't want to be, you know, we don't want to be seen to be an obstacle or a hurdle. Mm. Our job is really to make sure that everyone can find a way forward together in a way that sort of promotes and benefits everyone.
Yeah, I guess on that case as well, you'd want to tread carefully, that you don't want people thinking you're causing trouble, but you're just trying to understand, what you're entitled to or what you can and can't do.
Exactly right. And that's when you start looking at the scope of the agreements, what's, you know, what rights and obligations are there, and is there a way, effectively, is what we would look at, is there a way for these things to coexist? And if there's not, then okay, well, we're going to have to find another way to deal with it. But if there is a way that we can find, you know, a way forward together, then that's sort of our job, is to see what that could look like.
Yeah. And then in regards to, like, just say, and it probably varies quite largely, but like a standard player agreement in a, you know, in a large sport, what are the key considerations that they should be looking for outside, as I say, of your salary and your frequency of pay?
Yeah, well, as I said, it's really around the use of personal information, use of the image. So they're the main ones. Again, in the larger sports, you've got your standard form contracts, and you're not really allowed to deviate away from those standard terms without approval. So most of the time in those larger sports, that's already been sort of negotiated. The players' associations or the other unions will step in there and obviously make sure that everything's where they want it to be based on, you know, based on previous consultation with the players. So, as I said, there's been a lot more attention being placed on athletes' rights, and the players' associations becoming a lot more active and are starting to realise they probably have a bit more power than they probably thought they did you know, in the past. So you're seeing a lot more protections being provided for athletes in those standard form contracts based on those discussions and negotiations.
Okay. And then because it falls out of your jurisdiction, but if you do have, just say you've taken the deal overseas, right, and just looking at these basketballers I spoke with, they were going to countries like Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Dubai, right? This is where they're playing. Israel even, after a few weeks and they haven't been paid, which is, you know, quite standard from a lot of people I speak to be honest, that, you know, they might not be getting paid on time every time. What's the thought of, you know, outside of your agent, what's your first step in trying to, I guess, you know, get that back on track?
Yeah, well, it's actually an interesting issue. And I haven't actually had to deal with this in overseas jurisdiction. Obviously, we deal with commercial transactions, and international transactions in the commercial world, but not necessarily in the sporting space. But in that event, if there is a situation where an athlete's not being paid on time, I mean, the agent obviously has to raise it. Or the athlete, if they're comfortable with doing that. It's all about sort of making sure the tone of communications are still friendly, because we're all sort of, again, working together. We want to make sure that it's a long-lasting and beneficial relationship. So we need to make sure that any communication across is not combative, because that's just going to cause issues for everyone. So if, of course, after discussions between the athlete and the club or the agent and the club, things aren't really going where they should be, then we obviously look back at the terms of the contract and see what the process is. So most contracts will have a dispute resolution procedure. So that'll sort of set out, in the event that situations like this occur, what do we do? What's the process? And who can be involved? So in most commercial contracts and other sporting contracts, you'll have an opportunity to effectively set out like a dispute notice. That'll set out the details of the dispute, what you want to achieve from the matter, and then provides parties with an opportunity to sort of negotiate it or discuss amongst themselves before they take it to the next step. So with athletes, that's also something you should be looking at when you're actually signing a contract, is if things do go that way, then what are we going to do about it? And is there a set process there that we can sort of hold the other party accountable to? Because in the absence of a dispute resolution procedure, it's quite messy. The parties don't know what they need to do, and no one's compelled to really to do anything. So, you know, agreeing to the structure of that sort of procedure to begin with can be quite beneficial. It allows you the opportunity to actually have that process, know what you need to provide to the other party as far as details are concerned, and then sort of provides you that opportunity to resolve it prior to getting third parties involved, and typically after you fail to resolve disputes between yourselves, you usually do get a third party involved, such as like a mediator, to try and resolve the dispute. Some people might skip mediation and say, let's go to arbitration instead. But it's always good to have a three or four step approach to resolving disputes prior to actually commencing proceedings or reaching, a forum where a binding decision's made. So that's, again, where we come in, and we make sure that prior to entry, we're thinking about how do we get there. Obviously, we want to try and avoid disputes at all costs. No one likes going through those situations. But we want to make sure that there is a process to be followed.
And is that something like a dispute resolution clause or procedures? Is that something that you should find in most contracts?
Yeah. So if it's not in the contract, it could be in other governing documents as well. So when you sign up to a playing contract, they always say you obviously have to comply with any other rules or bylaws that are adopted from time to time. And if it's not in the contract itself, it will be set out typically in those other documents. So it's not just a case, especially when we're talking about international contracts. Obviously, it still applies in your local ones as well. But it is really important to look at the contract, but also all the other governing documents as well, because that might be where you find out about, use of your personal information or use of your image and what you might be entitled to. So the contract itself may not necessarily have all the information that you need.
But it might direct you to a CBA or something similar.
Exactly right.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And then another point, I guess, which would be a step further than that, but in the same sort of theme of things, is contract termination. Now, whether that's, pushed by yourself if you're not happy, or pushed by the club because you're not performing, how do players sort of protect themselves, in that realm? Or like that of one of the girls I spoke to last week, they were with a player in Israel. She just was completely homesick, a US, didn't even tell her team, just got on a flight and went home, just disappeared. Like, just, so obviously that's going to cause issues, but How would you address that, or what can the players do to sort of protect themselves, you know, or at least, I guess, preempt, you know, how do we go about this type of thing if I need to go home and I want to go home?
Yeah, so that's something to I think, consider before you enter into the contract as well is, you know, what if it isn't what I want it to be? Ones if I, you know, something like this happens, or even when you consider international playing contracts, is the ability to travel back home as well. And you know, at what intervals can you come home? So, you know, that's something that needs to be discussed in the first instance with the club. Obviously, if you have an agent representing your interests, and you obviously negotiate through them. Termination rights are quite interesting because usually it is the club that has more of the termination right than the athlete themselves. So it's usually a bit more favouring favours the club and the governing body themselves.
Employer in a way, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That's obviously in there to make sure that, you know, the club's protected, and obviously they're large organisations as well, so they need to make sure their interests are protected. So if there are doubts or there are any, you know, concerns that it may not last for long, then obviously you need to have that that chat in the front end. I mean, ultimately with termination and with employment generally, when an employee doesn't want to work for the employer, typically it is sort of in the employer's best interest to let them go anyway. So it is obviously important to negotiate termination rights to give the athlete some sort of flexibility. But ultimately, and you see it all the time, if an athlete says they want out or they want to move back home or something like that, then you know you're not going to get it as a club. You know you're not going to get the most out of them. So at those points in time, the club will have to consider whether it is in their interest to actually hold on to the employee and make them stay. Or otherwise let them go and negotiate some sort of exit terms.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's an interesting one because, you know, just from discussions I've had with people, they might take a deal like, you know, I've had girls, even guys that have either gone to Israel, Saudi, and these places that they've never been to before, you know, like it's their first time maybe out of their home country, and they've signed a contract through an agent. And then they get there and it's like, wow, shit, I don't want to be here. You know, what do we do now?
Yeah, absolutely.
And is that the same with, I was just going to say, is that the same with an agent? So if you've found an agent, which again, I keep coming across this, where they might have found someone, they don't feel like they're being represented properly or that they're getting what they were sold, you know, sold the dream.
Yeah, of course.
Is it a similar thing in regards to terminating an agreement with an agent? How easy is that?
Yeah, so again, sort of depends on what sport we're talking about because NRL, come back there as an example, they have standard form player and agent agreements that set out the termination rights aren't necessarily allowed to be deviated from without approval. I've worked on both sides of these kinds of disputes, so acting for the athlete with a dispute with the agent, acting for the agent in a dispute with the athlete. So, of course, the termination rights, each party's right is governed by the terms of the contract. And most of the time there is a contract in place. You'll have for the larger sports those standard form ones. So they'll set out, you know, what each party can do at certain points in time. So where the issues come up are, you know, the smaller sports where there is no standard form contract and it's really up to negotiation between the parties. That's where issues can arise because sometimes you might have an agent that wants to sign an athlete for 4 years and there may not be termination rights all the way through, you know, for convenience. So without cause, and that can sometimes be an issue. Sometimes athletes do want to get out early, or they feel like their interests aren't being represented properly. And it's sometimes difficult to mount an argument to say they actually have a recognized termination right based on a material breach of a contract. So for athletes, we're always being wary of signing up to long-term agreements, especially when you can't get out early, if you don't like it. Obviously for agents though, you know, they want to be remunerated for the work that they've done as well. So if there are contracts that have been negotiated, typically the contract will say they're still entitled to their commission for the contracts that are negotiated. But yeah, again, it's a matter of negotiation between the parties as to what that looks like. And again, there are more protections in those larger sports now for some athletes. They have certain periods of time. It's around 2 years, I think it is, the maximum period of time where an athlete can be signed up for an agent with an agent. And then after that, you can actually terminate for convenience. Okay. So, you know, there are some protections in place. But again, for an athlete signing with an agent, it's a big step. It's a very big step to take. It's a leap of faith. Mm. And a lot of careers can be determined by the quality of an agent. So, you know, sometimes when the athletes are coming up, they're a bit young. They probably haven't had exposure to a wide range of agents. Don't know a good service from a bad one either. Mm. So it's important for, you know, for athletes not to lock themselves into something long term, because they'll need to assess whether that's actually right for them. And again, it goes the same. The same goes for sporting contracts as well. You don't want to sign up too long if you're not sure about it. So yeah. It's always important to just get someone to run their eyes over it, to make sure that, you know, interests are protected. And again, there's more money in sports now, so you can sort of justify the cost a bit more. And sometimes people just jump in and hope for the best. And sometimes that's all they can do because maybe they can't afford, you know, legal advice at the time. But it's important when possible that they actually do get advice to make sure that their interests are protected. And again, everything says what they think it says.
Yeah. Yeah, no, the next question was, would you highly recommend, you know, a young athlete? Because like that, if you're offered your first professional contract, whatever age you are, like obviously you just want to sign it, you know, you just want to, you know, you want to achieve your dreams. But there are a lot of things to think about, and not that we want to bash agents, because some agents do a fantastic job.
Absolutely.
and really have your best interests at heart. But unfortunately, there's a lot of stories of, you know, vice versa where they're looking out for themselves. So I guess from an agent point of view and a player point of view, it's probably worth both of them checking things out and just making sure that it's a, you know, a win-win for both parties.
Yeah, exactly right. So as you said, there's plenty of good agents out there and in all of the sports as well. So it's just a matter of making sure that, you know, the terms are commercial, and the underlying tone of everything is we're all working together. We're all acting, you know, with the one goal in mind, and that's obviously to advance the athlete's interests. So again, it's just a matter of making sure that we don't lock ourselves into something for longer than we need to, and making sure that you actually do sort of do your research, make sure that, you know, the people you surround yourself with are the people that are going to be best suited to, you know, protect your interests and further them moving forward.
And on that part then, with sponsorships, what are, if you've come across it before, I guess some of the red flags as such, or things to be aware of if you're going to enter into an agreement with a sponsor, with a commercial partner?
Yeah, of course. So as you said, sometimes for athletes, the income that they actually generate from sponsorships can exceed the amount they're actually entitled to under their playing contract. So this is obviously a very important part of their career and their sort of their life generally. So for us, we always want to be involved in sponsorships when there's a contract involved, any kind of endorsement contract. We just want to have a look at that to make sure the athlete's rights are adequately protected. And when I talk about the rights, again, we're looking at image rights. So again, an athlete themselves don't really have a recognized right to the use of their own image. So that's quite important to realize. But we can get the protections in through contracts. So what we'd be doing there is we'd be saying, okay, what does the sponsor really need to promote the affiliation with the athlete? How are they going to do it? What images, what names are they going to use? And what degree of control does the athlete have over that? So there we're really looking at approval rights in relation to the use of the image. So before an image goes out, the sponsor then is required to go to the athlete and say, this is what we propose to do. Are you okay with this? Does it convey the message that you're happy with? And then in relation to image rights as well, we want to have a look at how long those images can be used for as well. So I've seen contracts before where you have a four-year term for an agreement, and then there's an image right provided to the other party for 15 years. So 11 years after the contract's been terminated. So you want to make sure that your image is used when you want it to be and for as long as you want it to be as well, because for athletes, specifically those on the rise, you want to be making sure you're not giving too much away, because that image, those affiliations can be worth quite a lot. And if you've got these lingering rights owed or obligations owed to other or previous sponsors, then that can sort of reduce the value of the future contracts as well. So we want to tie that up, make sure it says exactly what we want it to say, to make sure that obviously rights are protected now, but also into the future.
And just to like you know, dumb that down a little bit in like a real life sense. If I've signed with sponsor A and I've got a 2-year agreement, but in the back of the contract, I haven't read it, they've got a 10-year image rights.
Yep.
So for the next 8 years, they can keep using my image and promote their goods using myself, but I don't get a cent. I'm not entitled to anything. But is that how it would work?
Well, yeah. Well, that's right. So sometimes, and again, this was quite a unique contract that I saw that it contained that clause, but that's effectively how it would operate. So you're provided with the services, but then there's an ongoing right provided to the other party that survives termination effectively. And because that's just an advertising right, there's really no revenue share arrangement or anything connected with that. So, yeah, there was nothing tied to it. And the other party was effectively allowed to use that image for that period without any other compensation to the athlete.
It's a long time.
It is a long time. And again, I had the conversation with the athlete and said, well, you know, this contract says, you know, there's a 15-year image right here or a license. He said, I wasn't aware. I just, you know, I negotiated myself. I sort of trusted the guy and I thought that would work out. But, you know, actually in that matter, I was dealing with a breakdown in the relationship. So it was one of those things where I'd say, well, this is what they're potentially entitled to, and we need to figure out what we need to do to protect your interest moving forward.
Wow. And on that then, and again, it's probably quite a very open question because it could be so different, but do you find when you look at athlete sponsorship agreements that it's usually an upfront payment the athlete might get, or it's like that, a revenue share, or it's just split over, you know, a 12-month period? Is there anything that stands out more than others or not really?
I mean, usually it's it depends on the product. It depends on the arrangement. Say, for example, if you have your own signature shoe, then there's obviously you're going to be asking for revenue share entitlements. But if it is just a sort of a standard basic sponsorship, you'll usually see like an annual fee being paid to the athlete, and they'll receive that. But otherwise, you know, there's other incentives as well. If they, you know, reach certain heights, if they get representative honors, then you know, they might be entitled to other bonuses and stuff in connection with that sponsorship. But otherwise, it ultimately depends on the transaction, what you're trying to achieve, because you might have a sponsorship in its truest form where you have a right to use an image in connection with, you know, in return for the provision of goods or services, for example. Other times you might have some sort of arrangement where the athlete actually is offered equity in the, you know, the business or the company that's promoting certain products or services. So that's when things get a bit more complicated, and at that point in time we say absolutely you need to get advice, because we need to make sure that everything's tied up, because those kind of arrangements can last for a very long time.
And do the players, I guess the players could have like it could be a really good collaborative type approach. If you find a good sponsor and like that, you're an up-and-coming athlete that hopefully you can sit down and negotiate or get maybe a lump sum, but in year two we might, if things are going well, then we get a revenue share, and year three we can buy into, you know, 10% of the business or whatever it may be.
Yeah, well, that's right. Yeah, and I think it's rewarding athletes for increased reach as well. So if you look at some of the top athletes in each of the sport, obviously the young ones coming through, they might not have that kind of value right now, but in a few years time they'll be reaching a lot more people than what they were at the start of the contract. So as the athlete and obviously the agents, you want to make sure that there is an ability to unlock that value later down the track. So incorporating those kind of bonuses or incentives within the document will obviously, you know, assist the athlete in realizing their true value.
Just on that, it just popped into my head there, but the influence of social media in those types of things then, how obviously it's important, but do you have protection over your social media? Do you need to then sign over, you know, not access as in day-to-day access, but you know, is that part of where a sponsor might come to you and say, all right, but you need to make 10 posts a year about our company, something like that?
Yeah, so usually for a sponsor, you're looking for the benefits. You want to try and lock in and provide certainty and clarity around what you're actually going to get. So an athlete might say, a sponsor might say, we want, you know, to post, you know, 2 or 3 times about our products. We'll give you the products. You do what you need to do. It can be more informal. Again, if you're talking about a low-value transaction, they might not have too many controls around it. But then when you're talking about the higher value ones, and, you know, the sponsor is going to want to have a fair bit of control about what and what the content looks like. But so they're not necessarily going to hand over control, but there will be controls around what images can be used, and you know, the sponsor's right to sort of disagree with the publication of certain images. But otherwise, in relation to the use of social media, sponsors are always going to want effectively what's called like a morality clause in their contract. So that's when, again, for athletes, it's important for them to understand what they're signing up for, because these morality clauses, which are effectively a clause which says if you have done something that is considered to be wrong, or maybe, you know, it has the potential to be wrong, or, you know, you committed a crime or something like that, that could potentially affect the sponsor's reputation or even the athlete's reputation, then the sponsors typically provide themselves with a termination right or a way to get out. So that's when we look at social media. Obviously, people are free to post really what they want online, but when, you know, you start crossing some moral boundaries, then sponsors might start looking at the terms of their contract to see what they can and can't terminate the contract for. And morality clauses are always negotiated. They're always argued over, because a sponsor wants obviously a wide ranging morality clause. Effectively, if you do anything that they consider to be wrong, then they can get out. Whereas an athlete effectively wants it to be narrow and says, okay, well, let's actually define what this is, what kind of conduct you're trying to control, so that I know what I can and can't do, and I'm not going to have that uncertainty lingering every time I post a, you know, or post something on my Instagram, or, you know, post a story, anything like that.
Yeah, I was just thinking that it would probably cause some sort of limit to what you can then put on social media, because it could be religious, it could be political, it could be it could be a number of things which, yeah, then cause a red flag for the company that are paying you to post other stuff.
Yeah, exactly right. And obviously in this day and age, companies are very protective over their image. They understand that there's a lot that can sort of create outrage now. So they're really sensitive about, you know, what they're going to allow, particularly when, again, you're talking about those high-value transactions where someone might be known as like a Puma athlete or a Nike athlete, for example. In those circumstances, they're really going to want those controls to make sure they have the final say over, you know, who's actually going to be an ambassador for their brand.
Yeah, no, definitely. It's very important. As you say, is that, you know, just one word in someone's, you know, podcast, video, whatever, it just can get turned around and splashed over social media very quickly and taken the
Absolutely.
Wrong way.
Yeah, 100%.
And something you mentioned at the start, which I'll touch on there. So with, an athlete, you know, they're on a salary and they get some bonuses, et cetera, but they want to start taking up sponsorships or doing something away from sport and using their image. Is that where you would advise, and I'll be guided by you here, but setting up a different structure outside of your personal brand?
Yeah. So from a liability perspective, obviously on the legal side, we like to see when athletes are starting their own venture or enterprise, as we'd call it, separate to their sport. It would be ideal from our perspective for, you know, a separate structure. And when I say structure, you know, a company or something to be set up, sometimes a trust as well, just to limit the personal liability for the athlete. So sometimes from a tax perspective, and accountants would be best to talk about that, but from a tax perspective, you might not necessarily be able to avoid any income coming through, especially when you're talking about image rights. You might not be able to avoid that tax being assessed in your hands as an individual. But when you start talking about your sort of more commercial activities, such as, you know, starting your own business, or you know, most athletes like to try and capitalize on their brand or their reputation by starting a clothing business, for example. And when you're doing that, from our perspective, it's always important for a company to be set up to protect the individual from anything that happens in connection with the running of that kind of business. So that's the best way to, from our perspective, to set things up. And again, you might have a trust involved as well that can provide certain advantages for the athlete. But whenever we start talking about businesses, we start talking about structures and not just running things in our own name.
Yeah, definitely. That's what I thought. And do you find that, and then the transition from, say, getting people getting close to retirement, is there anything they have to be aware of? Or again, is it just a conversation around what do we do next? And there might be a structure needed to be set up, or there might be, you know, just ways to wind things down?
Yeah. So, I mean, ideally for an athlete, and again, this is where agents come in as well, the conversation about retirement and what happens post-sport should really happen immediately, even at the start of the career. I know personally for me, I had a rugby league background, and going through school all the way but to almost the finish of high school, my plan A and my only plan was to play rugby league. I was in some ways fortunate enough to actually acquire a spinal injury towards the end of school, which actually forced me to think about the plan B and gave me enough time to actually take the necessary steps to set myself up for, you know, a career outside of sports. So, and for athletes, it can happen overnight. You're one sort of ACL away from retirement effectively. So it's important for athletes and their agents to be aware that, you know, you're going to be an athlete for a finite period of time, and we need to make sure that there is a plan in place from the outset as to what we're going to do, how we're going to capitalize on the use of this this identity throughout your playing career, but also once it is time to hang up the boots or whatever you want to do, there should be a seamless transition. And again, in the larger sports, you're seeing the setup through for rugby league or the RLPA. They're doing a really good job at the moment with transitioning athletes into retirement. But that conversation doesn't take place at retirement. It takes place well prior, so that athletes are thinking about it. And then when it is time to hang up the boots, they already know what they're doing, or they're already doing it. And some athletes already have their businesses they're running. It is sort of a seamless transition. What you don't want to have is have that conversation in the back end or after you've acquired an injury, and then you're trying to figure out what you're doing, and whilst also dealing with what most athletes do, which is an identity crisis. That's really important.
Yeah, it was another thing that came up a few weeks ago in a conversation, someone that had started a business 5 years ago. They're still playing now, but yeah, because it gives you sort of, I guess, risk-free in a way to try things. You've got your salary through sport, and even though you have to have, you know, especially at the top level in sport, you have to have such focus on your sport to perform at that level. But as you say, you're potentially one injury away from it being over, or, you know, a bad contract or a bad agent, whatever it may be. It is important to keep that. And I think it also helps take your mind off, you know, the day-to-day training, performing. You do also need something else. So if you can think about, just putting plans in place, not for retirement, but for sports retirement, to then catapult you into something new. Because, as you say, it can be an identity crisis. A lot of people struggle with that transition from finishing playing whatever sport they're doing to what do we do next.
No, absolutely. And I mean, for professional athletes, there is usually a fair bit of downtime for them. So it'd be great if nothing else, and this is sort of veering away from strictly legal advice, but if they're focusing on, you know, running their own business as opposed to, you know, sitting around, there's a lot of obviously issues with gambling and things like that with professional athletes who do have a lot of time and obviously a lot of money as well. But that's where obviously, again, agents and the governing bodies come in to try and provide support, provide the education. And that's sort of my role as well, and my objective through, you know, provision of legal advice is to sort of assist athletes in understanding what they can do and what they really should be thinking about now from our, you know, a legal perspective to ensure that they set themselves up for success again during their career, but also post-career.
Yeah, and it's a big driver behind this whole overseas athlete idea is, you know, if you need help with currency, obviously we've got SportsFX. You need legal help, you need tax help, you need, you know, advice around sponsorships. And it's just having the right people there that, you know, you can reach out to, ask some questions. You might not use it now, but at least if you've got some sort of network of good, trusted professionals, it can just help you along the way while you're trying to juggle, you know, a lot of things.
Yeah, no, and I agree completely. So, again, my objective is to educate, but also to provide my clients with a wide network of service providers as well that will assist them moving forward as well. Because, again, we talked about agents, but an athlete's career can be determined by the quality of their support network. Mm-hmm. So if we can support athletes by having the right people around them from the outset, people who are used to working together, then things can be a lot easier for the athlete. They can focus on what they need to focus on, and then they know that everything else has been looked after by, you know, the network around them.
Yeah. No, fantastic. And that's probably a fantastic way to wrap it up, because we're both on the same page. That's obviously why, you know, I've got you on, because we're passionate about it. And I know from talking to these athletes that they do need help in all these areas. So the more, you know, professional and, you know, well-equipped service providers we can put in front of them, the better. So, Matthew, thank you very much for your time and your information today. And I'll obviously post all of your details and contact details on this at the bottom of this podcast.
Yeah, perfect. No, thanks, Chris. I appreciate it.
No problem at all.